Ready to connect with the investment community here in Cleveland? Want to learn about the people, events, projects, and firms that are making a difference? Want all that but feel like you don't have the time? This is the show for you. Welcome to Guardians of Finance. Brought to you by the CFA Society of Cleveland and hosted by Matt McLaughlin, portfolio specialist at Diamond Hill Capital Management, Guardians of Finance will provide you with a chance to foster deeper connections and know what is getting the attention of Cleveland's investment community. Subscribe to the podcast on your favorite podcast platform and head to guardiansoffinance.com where you can connect or reconnect with the CFA Society of Cleveland and attend an educational or social event and find volunteer opportunities. And now, here's your host, Matt McLaughlin.
Welcome to the Guardians of Finance podcast. I'm your host, Matt McLaughlin. In this episode, we talk with Tony Gattuso, Senior Director of Investments at the Cleveland Foundation. The Cleveland Foundation is one of Cleveland's most prominent foundations and has a long and storied history. Tony takes us through his career path, what he sees as the benefits of having an in-house investment function, and the origins of his nickname, one of the best we've heard on the podcast. Thanks for listening, and we hope you enjoy this episode with Tony Gattuso. Tony, welcome to the podcast.
Oh, thank you, Matt.
Just to start off, the Cleveland Foundation is a pretty well-known organization here in Cleveland, but being a transplant to Cleveland, I know when I first came about the organization and the name of it, I wasn't sure exactly what you guys did. And after doing a little research, obviously, I found out, but maybe that's a good jumping off point. Yeah, maybe give us your role at the Cleveland Foundation and what the goal of the foundation is and kind of how you contribute to that goal.
Yeah, so the Cleveland Foundation is the nation's oldest community foundation, dating back to 1914, founded by Frederick Goff. It's a tremendous story, and it speaks to the rich legacy that Cleveland has and Cleveland's inherited. Back in 1914, I like to think that Cleveland was kind of like what Silicon Valley is today, the center of economic activity and wealth. Is kind of well-known. Euclid Avenue was, I think, one of the wealthiest streets in the world, I think, at one point. And you see that even today, the rich legacy that Cleveland has from the art museum, the world-class healthcare institutions, world-class educational institutions, and our community foundation, really dating from that time. Frederick Goff had an idea that was, I think, really innovative and maybe a little crazy as far as philanthropy was concerned back at that time. But he really saw the need for communities to build wealth and there be a source of community wealth for generations to come. He saw the tremendous wealth was being created in Cleveland at that time and was really worried about this idea of a dead hand where philanthropists of the turn of the century were really be limited to what they could imagine the needs for a community being at that time. And his real innovation insight was this idea that there needs to be something that will carry out the legacy and the desire of these philanthropists to really drive positive change in Cleveland for generations to come. And even knowing that the things that Cleveland needs weren't going to be the things that were necessarily known or thought of back in 1914, 1920, that there'd be community leaders that would assemble on the board of this foundation to really make sure that those dollars will be aligned in perpetuity. So that's really kind of the legacy that we have here at the foundation. And my role and my small part of that is really helping lead over $3 billion in assets that have been left to the foundation that we steward in support of that mission and giving dollars back to the citizens of Greater Cleveland. Last year, we granted out, I think, roughly $140 million into the community, really across all areas, education, arts, culture, economic development. And it's really that legacy and something I think all the staff here at the foundation takes seriously is our responsibility as stewards of that great community wealth.
Sure. At a high level, how do you guys decide how to distribute that money? Is it kind of on a yearly basis? Is there overarching goals that drive it? How does that work?
Yeah, so we're very fortunate. We have a world-class grant-making team here at the foundation that really, I think, is unrivaled as far as their understanding of the needs of Cleveland and the philanthropic community here in Northeast Ohio. So they do a great job of helping us understand where those dollars should be directed. The dollars overall kind of fall into two big buckets. The first being donor-directed dollars. So these are dollars where the donor is either explicitly, in the case of a designated institution, to get that money, or it could be unrestricted where the donor says, okay, this can go to the best purpose, or field of interest where they say, okay, here's a narrower subset, maybe it's education, but then our grant-making team can make recommendations for where those dollars go. those recommendations ultimately, based on size, will go up to our board for approval. And then that's how those dollars get out to the community. The last kind of bucket there is the donor advised funds, which is a relatively new innovation. I think it's been around, actually goes back to like 1913 from New York Community Trust, but really kind of took off in the 80s and beyond, where donors have a lot more flexibility to give money. So that's another portion of the dollars that go out into the community every year, is those dollars that are directed by the donor through their donor advised funds.
That's really neat. Thanks for that explanation. Maybe turning to you and your personal background, were you born and raised a Clevelander, or are you a transplant like myself?
Well, I was born in Western New York. I was born in Buffalo, grew up in between Buffalo and Rochester. My mother's still in Rochester. But when I was five, my family moved to Youngstown. So my father's in the Marine Corps. And when he got out, he got into Youngstown State. So I grew up in the Youngstown area, spent my formative years there, and then went back to Western New York, the St. Bonaventure University. So if you're a fan of Atlantic 10 basketball or mid-major basketball, you may know St. Bonaventure, which has actually a really rich basketball history. So that's where I went. And then coming out of school, I got a job at Cleveland Clinic, my first job in finance. So I was very fortunate to get there, which was a fantastic experience and has really led to so much of what has happened to me professionally for my time there.
Was the goal to get back to Cleveland, or is that just an opportunity that just popped up on your radar and you just happened to think that was the best path to go forward with?
Yeah. So my goal as a student in New York was really to go to New York City. So I kind of had the naive view that all finance had to take place on Wall Street. The time I graduated, it's like 2005. So not quite at the financial crisis, but I had a really good friend of mine. We both went through interviews with Goldman Sachs coming out. So Goldman was at school, kind of went through that process. And I just remember being crushed when I didn't get the job. I'm like, okay, I'm not going to get to go to New York City. And that time my father's here in Cleveland. So I thought, okay, Cleveland Clinic will make sense. I can hang out there for a little bit until I can get back to New York City. And I think it was 2 years into it when the financial crisis, and I remember talking to my buddy, and it was this crazy time, and he ended up losing his job, which I kind of missed out on all that excitement, which was probably a good thing. I had a little different experience of being in the clinic during the financial crisis, which was interesting in its own way, but if I worked out, I didn't get laid off by Bear Stearns.
So your dad was in the Marine Corps, maybe your mom worked as well, but doesn't sound like there was a heavy financial influence in your upbringing. What was maybe the first memorable kind of experience you had with markets or finance, or what made you go down that career path with finance and investments?
So it's actually my mom. My mom is really the driver behind it. When I was a kid, she was a branch manager for a bank outside of Youngstown, Ohio. So I remember I would go visit her and I'd sit in the back and play with the calculators and the typewriters and see all the money going into the ATMs, and I thought it was really cool. So I was exposed to finance through that. I initially wanted to be a lawyer, which my wife ended up doing. So I get more than enough exposure to that. But I thought that's what I want to do. But then it wasn't high school. I think it was a Fortune magazine or one of, I remember there's a write-up one of those business magazines did on Novartis. And that was like the first time I like read about a business in detail. And I was so excited. I sent them a letter and they mailed me their financial statements. And I remember I went through all of them and dug into that and really enjoyed that. And I came up with this whole proposal that I shared with my parents, who, my mom worked at a bank, but was not an investor by any stretch. And they were not as impressed. And I don't think the stock ended up working out, but it got me excited about it. And I thought it was pretty cool. So that was kind of my driver when I realized I didn't want to go to law school, but I kind of liked Excel and numbers. So that was my exposure there.
Did you always want to end up as a stock picker?
That's my dream was, like, okay, I'm going to go work at Bear and I'm going to get some experience and then go start a hedge fund. That's what I thought I'd do. And I was really fortunate that I got the call. So it's probably good that it didn't work out with Bear Stearns. And it was really fortunate that it worked out at Cleveland Clinic. I remember I got the call and I'd actually missed it. They left me a voicemail and I had another offer. And I was talking to my dad at that time. And he's like, you know what? Oh, the clinic's a pretty good place. There'll be a lot of experience. You could see a lot of different things. But the role was for treasury coordinator, treasury analyst. And I remember thinking like, oh, there's not really a lot of investments there. Like, I don't want to do corporate finance. And I did it just because he's like, yeah, it's the clinic's look on a resume. It'll be a good experience. And he was right. It was great. And it was a very interesting time at Cleveland Clinic. They just, I think, brought in some of the Eastern hospitals and the Western hospitals. So it was this consolidation. And as it turned out, it ended up being there at this moment, at least for the investment function at the Cleveland Clinic, that really, I think, was transitional, where it went from I think, $2 billion to when I left, we were probably about $10 billion when I ended up leaving Cleveland Clinic. So just saw tremendous change and went from kind of a traditional treasurer model where the treasurer would meet with a consultant and they take some recommendations to the investment committee to ultimately when I left, they hired their first chief investment officer. And I got to see firsthand him build an investment team, which was just really impactful and really helped shape what I wanted to do professionally and seeing that. So I was very fortunate that whole way. A lot of great mentors there that gave a 20-year-old analyst a lot of opportunity to engage with an organization that was changing really rapidly.
So what was the catalyst for thinking, hey, maybe I wanted to expand my horizons a little bit or look somewhere else, or maybe it was another organization, the Cleveland Foundation, reach out to you and attracting you? What was the reason for the change there?
Cleveland, Ohio, there's not a whole lot of foundations and endowment investment opportunities. There's Roseanne Potter, who's our CFO today here at the Cleveland Foundation. I met her before. There's a group called Cleveland-Pittsburgh Pension Group where institutional investors in Cleveland and Pittsburgh get together. And I'd known her from there, and she managed the pension at Eaton at the time. And she had left to come here at the foundation. And I think her vision for really building an investment function here internally at the foundation was really exciting to me. And the thing, it really just kind of fit with my experience at Cleveland Clinic, where I saw the investments go from a small function that was just part of a treasurer's job to, at one point, it was outsourced to an outsourced CIO, which was actually a great opportunity for me too. I got to go out and travel and meet with real experienced investors through that experience to in the process of bringing the assets back internal and building that really sophisticated investment team that they have today. Seeing that really left an impression on me, and this opportunity to do that at the Cleveland Foundation and take that experience and knowledge and apply it here was just really exciting. And there isn't that many opportunities in Cleveland to do that. So I had to take that opportunity.
Something like you saw them go from an outsourced CIO to kind of an internal and build that function. What are the big benefits that you saw be realized through that process?
Yeah, I think the benefits from bringing assets in. So here at the Cleveland Foundation, I think the thing that it really does is allows us to really align very closely with mission and build an investment program that really fits the organization. So for us, mission is a huge component of that. But go to other organizations, it's being able to really align operationally better. But here, it's that flexibility and the ability to have the resources internally to really position the portfolio in the way that's most effective for our stakeholders. I think it's really compelling.
Looking back through your career and hearing you describe it, you've been with two organizations your entire career, which I almost feel like is rare in this kind of day and age. What do you attribute that to? You rose through one organization, then went to a different one and kind of rose through that. What do you attribute that to?
The first thing is probably my family and my coworkers would probably agree, like I'm a very patient person. So, and maybe that reflects too in the way I think about investing. There's the making sure you fill your buckets, right? Of knowledge, skills, experience. And for me, that was really important. I was very fortunate. Both organizations I've been at have been tremendous opportunities. I think fill my knowledge and skill buckets. And that was really important to me. And I think I recognize that. So, you know, I think what little skills or wisdom I may have, that was one thing I think that's always kind of stuck with me is like, hey, there's a lot of really smart people and I owe it to myself to try to learn as much as I can from them, which was 100% my experience at the clinic where I remember the director of finance, then the treasurer and investment director there, and the whole team is just very willing to share information. Our the chief investment officer really took the time to mentor me and guide me through investments. And I wanted to make sure I picked up as much as possible and got all that information I could out of that, those situations. And for me, those relationships are still important today and play a really big role in how I think about investments. I still use them as, you know, a sounding board for ideas today.
Sure. Do you think being a patient person, was that something you learned or was that something you were born with?
As everyone, I probably learned a little bit, but I think it's probably something, it's one of the things I was born with to an extent. It's really hard, but I think it's super important with investing as well, to be able to be patient. And the market will give you a lot of noise and will be a lot of volatility. But if you have confidence in the research that you've done and the work you've put into it, it makes being patient a little easier.
You don't have to get into specific managers or naming names, but can you think of a time where your patience was really rewarded from an investing perspective and maybe just kind of go through kind of your thought process in that time?
Yeah. So we had one manager, I think more recently, kind of coming off the COVID rebound and then this tech sell-off. Going into 2022, we had a managers down really significantly, I think down about 50%. And it was really tough to kind of reiterate, but we looked through the positions and they're just phenomenal names. They were down, but it was pretty clearly the market just saying anything that had to do with tech at that time was just getting destroyed. So anything with the growth bias would have been rewarded for 10 years was now being thrown out. And you look at the companies and like, these are blue chip companies that are excellent. You know, Google's, Amazon's, Microsoft's of the world. And we looked at that portfolio and it made sense. It's like, you know, hey, we have to be convicted in this. So we actually increased our investment. We dug through it and that was rewarded. We had the really nice rebound in the portfolio last year. So yeah, I think that's a situation where it paid off and the patience comes from data and understanding what you're holding.
In that kind of a situation, do you try to build consensus and get everyone's opinion and try and shape it a certain way? How do you let that decision happen and let that patience be rewarded? Or how does the patience make its way into the decision-making?
Yeah, I think how patience makes its way, it has to come from being clear as you go into a position, why you're in the position and the fundamentals. And you hear that a lot from managers. So in my seat, we meet with a lot of managers and they all come in and talk about like when the thesis breaks and the different reasons for selling. But I think they'll say, because there's some truth that you really have to understand why you're in it. And if you don't have a solid understanding of why you're taking a position, it's easy to get whipsawed by the market. For us, we tend to have a growth-oriented investment allocation, and that is well aligned. And we're a long-duration assets. We've been around for 110 years. We fully plan for another 110. And if you have that lens and you say, okay, we're comfortable with a reasonable amount of volatility, and you underwrite your positions to that, and you're explicit with your committee with that, I think that's how you do that. And we're very fortunate. I would put our investment committee up against anyone in the world. We have some phenomenal chief investment officers from large institutions on our committee, and they're a tremendous resource. So maybe if a different committee, it might be harder to do. But when you have a thoughtful, experienced committee of investment professionals and members of the community that are really engaged and understand what we're trying to do, that's the support that is so important when you're in my position, that we could lean on them to ride through those times when the market isn't going in your favor.
We're 3-4 months into the year now. What has been the most talked about thing for you and your staff so far this year from an investing perspective?
Yeah, so the most talked about thing. Well, I think there's the thing that we talk most about with donors and others is probably AI, right? That gets brought up. So that, which is interesting itself. We had a great donor event, I think a month ago, where we talked on that and shared kind of our views and then also brought in some excellent speakers. So AI comes up a lot. It seems like it's here to stay and it's really going to fundamentally change the way we work, kind of on the same order of the internet and oil back in the 1900s. The thing that our team internally thinks about a lot more than AI is where we're at currently in this market, where we've had a great year last year, year to date, we've had really, really strong returns. But where do we go from here kind of as we move into the next, well, now less than 9 months of the year? How can we position for inevitably what will be some of the volatility that we see as we move towards, it's an election year, there's conflict in the Middle East, valuations, they're probably not cheap anymore being conservative. So how are we positioned? How are we going to be ready for the volatility that we know we're going to see? And for us, that's when we start to think about where we're at from a policy standpoint, where we're deviating. And it's never bad to be aligned with your policy in times when you could be nearing another inflection. And that's kind of what we're thinking about right now is what does the next 9 months look like coming off really, really strong 12 months?
Sure. You mentioned the Cleveland-Pittsburgh Pension Group. And even though they're a rival to the CFA Society, which we don't need to No, tell us a little about that group because I've heard about that and I'm sure people in the financial community have heard about what is that group? What are they about? And we'd love to hear a little bit more about that one.
Yeah, so the Cleveland-Pittsburgh Group, it's been going on. I was fortunate to be the president of the group for a few years, actually during COVID. So that was a fun experience as well. But that group is a group of institutional investors that get together and share ideas. So it's a chance for us to have kind of a roundtable, small group to discuss challenges we're facing as institutional allocators. And I always think of it as kind of like this nice, like maybe safe space where allocators can kind of get together and say, okay, these are the challenges we're having, whether it's regulatory issues around pension plans or allocating to managers. It's kind of a nice safe space for us to get together, have some breakfast and talk about challenges we're facing.
That's not just a place to go complain about your committees, is it?
No.
I'm just kidding. That is a complete joke.
No. No, it might happen occasionally, but not from the foundation standpoint.
For sure. For sure. Outside of work, what are your passions?
So I have two girls, a 10-year-old and a 5-year-old, and they're both into soccer. So that's my main passion is taking them to soccer practices and all the other activities. Aside from that, I'm a big soccer fan as well. So I'm a Tottenham Hotspur fan, which fits very well with also being a Cleveland Browns fan. So if you're familiar with Premier League soccer, I think they're essentially the Cleveland Browns of the Premier League, eternally optimistic and constantly disappointed, skiing and occasional golf.
Sure. That's a lot of pain you go through in your sports fandom.
Yeah. So you talked about patience, right? That was the main thing. And I think it probably comes from being lifelong Browns fan and Spurs fan. So it's taught me patience and humility.
Sure. In mid-major basketball, I'm no expert, but St. Bonaventure, they tended to be good or better, I should say. I don't mean to insult them, but they were really good in the 90s and 2000s, but maybe haven't been as good recently. Do I have my mid-major basketball history
yeah.
right?
Yeah. Yeah. So going back historically, so they come from Bob Lanier was back in the late 60s or 70s. Bob Lanier is the kind of put St. Bonaventure basketball on the map. During my tenure, so I graduated in 2001. And that was right towards the end of, they had a really good run. So I think the year before my freshman year, they played Kentucky, took them to overtime and lost in the first round. Then there was actually a scandal during the middle of my tenure at Bonas. If you remember, there's like a recruiting issue and then they didn't play at the end of the season. So as a student during that time, the exciting part was ESPN was there filming. I remember being in the dining hall and I'm like, okay, I'm a small university in Western New York. And we have ESPN like doing reports about it. But fortunately, they turned it around, and in the last few years, basketball's gotten a lot better. And Andrew Nicholson was the last one to get drafted, I think, a few years ago. Or actually, it's probably like 10 years ago, now that I'm getting older. But yeah, so mid-major basketball is my other guilty pleasure.
Sure. That's a good transition, and we'll start it off kind of the rapid-fire question round where we kind of go through it. Just a couple lighthearted questions. Maybe start it off with favorite mid-major basketball moment.
Personally, it was... St. Bonaventure played UCLA in the play-in game down in Dayton. So actually my cousin came down from Buffalo. It was like a blizzard, which was perfect because like that's what Western New York basketball is about, like driving in blizzards. And we drove down to Dayton and saw them play UCLA and they won. So that was my favorite mid-major basketball moment, me actually seeing Bonas win a NCAA tournament game.
That's cool. This is usually the lead-off question for the rapid fire, but do you have a nickname?
Oh, I do. Interesting enough, when I was in middle school, they would call me Pasta.
Pasta.
So that was I was also a catcher. So I played catcher in baseball. And it came from after practice one day, I was like, oh, yeah, I'm just going to go home. Mom made pasta today. So the coach was like, hey, Gattuso, is that all you eat is pasta? And it kind of stuck. So that was my high school nickname.
That's a good one. You mentioned you love to go watch your daughters play soccer, but any other hobbies that are top of your list?
Yes, soccer and occasional game of euchre. So that's my other thing.
It's a good one.
Yeah, good Midwestern thing to do, I guess.
Maybe this goes along with your nickname, but favorite recipe to cook, if you're a cook.
Oh, yeah. So I'm not a cook, but my wife, who is not Italian, has really learned. I'll say she picked it up from my mother, but she just makes excellent lasagna. So going along with the pasta lasagna theme, lasagna is probably my favorite, and my wife does a great job.
Right. What's your favorite book about investing or finance?
Oh, my favorite book. There's so many good ones. One book I really enjoyed was Michael Wilbossom's book, Success Equation.
That's great. Profession you'd be in if you weren't doing what you're doing now?
Probably lawyer.
Favorite bucket list travel destination?
Anywhere with my family.
There you go. Any hidden talents?
Paper football. So if you know that game, kind of folding a paper football.
Oh, yeah.
One of the interesting facts about me, I think I was Western New York champion in paper football in college.
That is an awesome hidden talent. I am jealous.
Yeah. Yeah. So I went to there's a couple bars, I ended up competing at some bar in Buffalo.
What's the key to strategy there? Like, how did you become the best?
Practice. Practice and my patience, I think.
Fair enough. Favorite lunch spot in Cleveland?
Probably Gallucci's, because it's right next door. So fitting with pasta, I guess.
I'm sensing a theme here.
Yeah, yeah. Big fan of Italian food.
If you're active on social media, who's your favorite follow?
Oh, yeah. LinkedIn is probably as social media as I get. Yeah, I don't really follow anybody.
Most memorable Cleveland sports moment?
Oh, there are so many. One I personally enjoyed was us beating the 49ers last year. So I spent some time in Youngstown, and one of my friends is a really big 49ers fan. So we went to the game, and I didn't think there'd be any way we'd win. And then winning the way we did, that was probably one of my favorite recent moments as a Browns fan.
For sure. Well, that is all the hot seat questions I have for you. Tony, thanks for joining the podcast. It was great talking with you and appreciate you coming on.
Thank you, Matt.
You've been listening to Guardians of Finance, brought to you by the CFA Society of Cleveland. Subscribe to the podcast on your favorite podcast platform and head on over to guardiansoffinance.com, where you can connect or reconnect with the CFA Society of Cleveland, attend an educational or social event, and find volunteer opportunities. Thanks, and we'll see you next time on Guardians of Finance.